The ledger sat heavy against her ribs, each page a ledger of betrayal. Pearl moved through the streets with the urgency of someone carrying dynamite rather than paper. Doyle's handwriting filled the margins alongside strangers' cramped entries dates, amounts, initials that meant nothing to anyone but the men who'd written them. Holloway's name appeared in the margins more often than the full spelling. BW followed by sums that made her stomach turn. 500, 2,000, 500 again. Payments to aldermen. Payments to constables. Payments to a woman whose signature she'd never seen, but whose shadow she'd felt pressing against her throat since the day her father died. The notebook burned a hole in her coat pocket like a coal wrapped in cloth. Pearl walked fast, shoulders hunched against the rain, her boots splashing through puddles that reflected the sickly yellow glow of the gas lamps. She had promised Doyle to run, but running meant thinking, and thinking meant piecing together what she now held in her hands. The ledger was a mess of cramped handwriting dates, amounts, initials that meant nothing to anyone but the men who'd written them. Holloway's name appeared in the margins more often than the full spelling. BW followed by sums that made her stomach turn. 500, 2,000, 500 again. Payments to aldermen. Payments to constables. Payments to a woman whose signature she'd never seen, but whose shadow she'd felt pressing against her throat since the day her father died. And she knew now why the man in gray coat had waited outside Alina's door for an hour. He hadn't been watching her enter. He had been waiting for her to leave, ensuring the trap set for her on the rooftop would spring only when she carried the proof that could burn the city down. She needed answers, not flight. And the only person who might have them was the one person she was supposed to be avoiding. She had cataloged him the way she cataloged crime scenes, at Alina's door on Orchard Street, standing outside number 47 for an hour while Alina's hands shook behind the wood. In the subway tunnels, he'd been a presence behind her that never quite materialized into attack. He was not a man who shouted or threatened. He was a man who appeared, who watched, who waited. And now, she suspected he was the one who had followed her from the precinct, who had watched her through the rain-streaked windows as she paused at every corner, every shadow. She had seen him at Alina's door on Orchard Street, standing outside number 47 for an hour while Alina's hands shook behind the wood. She had felt him in the subway tunnels, a presence behind her that never quite materialized into attack. He was not a man who shouted or threatened. He was a man who appeared, who watched, who waited. And now, she suspected he was the one who had followed her from the precinct, who had watched her through the rain-streaked windows as she paused at every corner, every shadow. She was being followed. She knew it in the prickle along her spine, the hair rising at her nape despite the damp warmth of the rain. She kept her pace steady, her gaze fixed ahead. She was being followed. She knew it in the way her skin prickled, in the way the hair along her neck rose despite the damp warmth of the rain. She did not look back. She did not slow. The warehouse district opened up before her like a skeleton picked clean by time. Brick buildings, some three stories tall, their windows boarded or broken, their doors sealed with rusted chains. Most were dark. A few had lights burning inside, weak and wavering, casting orange halos through cracks in the wood. Pearl moved between them, her boots making no sound on the wet stone. She had learned that skill from her father, how to walk without announcing herself, how to be present without being seen. She had spent years perfecting it, years of shadowing men who thought themselves invisible, years of learning that the best detectives were the ones nobody noticed until it was too late. Then she saw it, a warehouse near the water's edge, its facade marked with a faded number she couldn't read through the grime. A single light burned in the upper window, casting a pale rectangle onto the wet street below. And standing beneath it, perfectly still despite the rain, was a figure in a gray coat. Her breath caught, not from fear, from recognition. She had seen that coat before, at Alina's door, in the subway tunnels. It was the same shade of gray, the same cut, the same way it hung on the wearer like a second skin, seamless and without ornament. The man in gray coat. He was waiting for someone, or watching for someone. Pearl pressed herself into the shadow of an adjacent building, her back against the wet brick, her pulse hammering in her ears. She had the notebook in her pocket. She had her brass scissors in her other pocket, worn smooth from years of use, carried since childhood. She was not armed with anything sharper than that, and she knew it. Confrontation was not her method. Observation was. She watched. 10 minutes passed, then 20. The rain intensified, drumming against the rooftops, turning the streets into shallow rivers. The figure in the gray coat did not move. He simply stood there, his hands in his pockets, his head tilted slightly upward as though listening to something above the sound of the rain. There was something almost ritualistic about his stillness, as though he were holding himself in place by sheer will. Pearl found herself studying him the way she studied a piece of fabric, looking for the weave, the texture, the pattern beneath the surface. Gray wool, heavy and water-resistant. No buttons visible, perhaps a concealed closure. The hem was slightly frayed, suggesting he wore it daily, without replacement. A man who did not care about appearances, or a man whose appearances were carefully controlled. Pearl's fingers found the notebook in her pocket. She thought of Doyle's face, the exhaustion, the fear, the resignation. He had given her this book to use, to wield. But how do you wield a ledger against a man who doesn't speak, who doesn't blink, who moves through the city like a draft of cold air? She needed to get closer. She needed to see who he was meeting, what he was guarding inside that warehouse. Pearl crept along the wall, keeping to the shadows, her boots finding purchase on the slick stone. The warehouse loomed larger as she approached, its brick face pockmarked with age, its doors sealed behind a padlock thick with rust. But the upper window, the one with the light, was cracked open a few inches, just enough for sound to escape. She pressed her ear against the wall, just below the window, and listened. Voices, two of them, low, murmuring. One was male, the other she couldn't tell. The rain drowned most of it, but she caught fragments. Not safe here. She knows too much. The ledger. Pearl's blood went cold. They were talking about her, about the notebook Doyle had given her, about the very thing she was carrying in her coat pocket. She shifted her weight and her boot scraped against the stone. A small sound, barely audible, but the voices stopped. Silence stretched, taut as a wire. Then footsteps, heavy, deliberate, descending from somewhere above. The man in gray coat was coming down. Pearl backed away from the wall, her heart pounding. She had seconds to decide, run or hide. She chose neither. Instead, she stepped out from the shadows and walked toward the warehouse door, her chin lifted, her hands empty and visible. She would not be hunted tonight. The door opened before she reached it. The man in gray coat stood in the doorway, his face half hidden beneath the brim of his hat. Up close, she could see him fully for the first time, pale, angular, with eyes that were neither warm nor cold, but simply absent, as though nothing behind them had ever stirred. He was younger than she expected. Mid-20s, maybe, but his face carried the weight of someone who had already lived twice his years. There was a scar along his jawline, thin and white, the kind that came from something sharp and close. "You followed me," he said. His voice was flat, devoid of inflection, like a stone dropped into still water. "I was already here," Pearl replied. Her voice was steady, though her hands trembled inside her coat. "You just haven't noticed." He tilted his head, a small, curious motion. "You are persistent, like a stain." "I'm a detective." A detective with a revoked license, a daughter of a dead man, a woman who walks into rooms she does not belong in. He paused. "You carry a book that does not belong to you." Pearl's hand drifted toward her pocket instinctively, then stopped. Denial would be useless. He already knew. He probably knew more than she did. "What do you want?" she asked. "Orders," he said simply. "I execute orders." "That is all." "Whose orders?" His expression did not change. "Does it matter whose orders? You are the one who broke them." Pearl swallowed. "I didn't break anything. I found a book, I read it, I'm trying to understand." "Understanding is dangerous," he interrupted. "Understanding leads to questions. Questions lead to answers. Answers lead to consequences. I prefer not to deal in consequences." He stepped closer. Pearl's instinct was to retreat, but she held her ground. She would not show fear, not to him, not to anyone. "You killed my father," she said. The words came out quieter than she intended, but they were there, hanging between them like smoke. The man in gray coat considered her for a long moment. Then he shook his head slowly. "No," he said, "I did not, I was not ready." The answer surprised her. She had expected denial, aggression, silence. Not this measured, almost regretful correction. "Not ready," she echoed. "He was protected by people above my rank, above yours, above anyone's." He turned slightly, glancing back into the warehouse. When the time comes, I will do what I must, but that time has not arrived. Pearl's mind raced. If he hadn't killed her father, if he had been ordered to but hadn't carried it out, then who had? Holloway? Blackwell? Someone else entirely. The pieces were shifting, rearranging themselves like threads on a loom, and she couldn't see the pattern yet. "Why are you telling me this?" she asked. "Because you deserve the truth," he said. "Not all of it, but enough." He reached into his coat. Pearl tensed, her hand closing around the brass scissors in her pocket. But he withdrew only a small object, a folded square of paper, stiff with age. He held it out to her. "This was in your father's coat," he said. "I took it from the scene. I have carried it since. I do not know what it means. Perhaps you will." Pearl took the paper. Her fingers brushed his briefly. His skin was cool, dry, calloused at the fingertips. She unfolded it carefully. Inside was a single line of writing in her father's hand, "Trust no one wearing gray." Her breath hitched. She looked up at the man in gray coat, but his face gave nothing away. Had he written this himself? Was this a joke? A test? Or was her father warning her about someone else, someone who wore gray but was not this man? The ambiguity was a knot she couldn't untie. "Who are you?" she whispered. He did not answer. Instead, he stepped aside, clearing the doorway. Behind him, the warehouse was dark save for the single lamp on the wall. Shelves lined the interior, stacked with crates and barrels and bundles of fabric, rolls of cloth, bolts of silk, the kind of inventory a shipping warehouse would hold. But something was wrong. The arrangement was haphazard, as though things had been searched and replaced without care. Several crates had been pried open and their contents scattered. A stack of invoices lay fanned across the floor like fallen leaves. "You may enter," he said. "Look, see what you came to see, then leave, and do not return." Pearl hesitated. This could be a trap. But the notebook in her pocket felt heavier than ever, and she needed answers. She stepped past him into the warehouse. The interior was cold, the air thick with the smell of damp wool and old paper. She moved slowly, her fingers brushing against crates and shelves as she went. Most of the items were ordinary shipping manifests, ledgers, invoices, but tucked behind a stack of empty boxes, she found what she was looking for. A ledger, not Doyle's. This one was larger, bound in dark leather, its pages filled with a different handwriting, neater, more precise. She flipped through it quickly. Names, dates, amounts, but these were not payments to politicians or policemen. These were payments to seamstresses, to tailors, to fabric suppliers. And at the bottom of each entry, a notation, 12 stitches. Her stomach twisted. 12 stitches. The same pattern she'd seen on her father's coat. The same pattern Alina had recognized. The same pattern that had brought her here, through months of investigation, through rain and fear and loss. This was the syndicate's ledger, the original one, the one Selah's Vane had tried to bury 6 months ago, the one her father had been hunting. The one that connected every payment, every bribe, every silenced witness back to a single source. The syndicate's original master, the man whose signature Pearl had examined in the silk knot and realized was not Vane's at all. She heard movement behind her. The man in gray coat had followed her in. He stood at the entrance, silhouetted against the dim light from the street, his gray coat blending into the shadows. "You have your answer," he said. Pearl closed the ledger carefully and slipped it into her coat beside Doyle's notebook. Two books, two truths, neither of them the whole truth. "Why let me see this? Why not stop me?" "Because seeing is not taking," he said, "and taking is not understanding." He stepped forward, and for a moment, Pearl thought he might seize the ledger from her. But he stopped a foot away, his hands still in his pockets. "You are your father's daughter," he said. "I can see it in the way you move, the way you look at things. You see patterns where others see chaos. That is a gift and a curse." Pearl said nothing. The compliment, if it was one, landed awkwardly. She was used to people calling her reckless, intrusive, unstable, not gifted. "I was going to kill you tonight," he continued. "That was the order. Find the girl with the notebook. End her." Her pulse jumped, "But you didn't." "No," he paused. "Something stopped me. I do not know what. Perhaps it was the rain. Perhaps it was the way you walked toward me instead of away. Perhaps it was the memory of a man who once told me that mercy is the only thing that separates us from machines." He turned toward the door. Go home, Miss Casey. Lock your doors. Burn the notebooks if you must, but do not come back here. Next time, I will not be so merciful. Pearl stood in the warehouse, the books heavy in her coat, the rain still falling beyond the door. She wanted to ask more questions. She wanted to demand answers. But she knew, with a certainty that settled deep in her bones, that this man would not give them. Not tonight. Not ever, if she pushed. He was a door that opened just wide enough to let you in and then closed behind you. She walked past him, out into the rain, and did not look back. The streets were empty, the gas lamps flickered. The city exhaled around her, vast and indifferent. Pearl pulled her collar tighter and turned west, toward the river, toward the silence, two books in her pocket. One belonged to Doyle, one belonged to the syndicate. Both pointed toward the same destination, Astrid Blackwell's townhouse on Fifth Avenue. The woman whose name her father had written in blood. The widow who hosted charity galas while her hands were stained with blood money. The woman Pearl was going to confront. Behind her in the warehouse, the man in gray coat watched her go. He did not move until she disappeared into the darkness. Then he closed the door, extinguished the lamp, and stood in the blackness, listening to the rain. For the first time in years, he wondered if he had made a mistake. He did not know how to live with that thought. So he buried it, the way he buried everything else quietly, efficiently, without ceremony.